Thank you very much, Mel. In Beijing, I learned that to be an effective diplomat, you need to talk softly and carry a big stick. Today, it is my great pleasure and true honor to introduce to you my big stick, who is also an accomplished diplomat advocating for U.S. values around the world. He is my friend, protector, having served in the U.S. Navy for 41 years, a much-decorated naval aviator with over 1,300 carrier-arrested landings. Believe me, that's not for the faint of heart. He is a former vice chief of naval operations, PACOM commander, where he was in charge of all U.S. forces in the Asia-Pacific region. That's an area covering two-thirds of the world's surface, including, I would know, all American citizens in China. He's the only naval officer to have ever been named CENTCOM commander, where such well-known generals as Petraeus and Flynn reported to him. He has been called one of the greatest strategic thinkers in the military, and he's widely known by his aviation call sign, Fox. Today, he's going to address us on the global strategic challenges confronting the United States with a focus on North Korea, China, the Middle East, and Russia. Without further ado, I give you a genuine American hero, four-star Admiral William J. Fallon.
There you go. Any doubt why Sandy was appointed ambassador from the United States to China? Well, it's an absolute delight to be down here, my wife and I, to come down from Washington to be here in Naples. It's been about a decade since we were here. And I have to tell you that the first time that I ever saw Naples was from the air many decades ago when I was learning how to fly Navy aircraft. I was based over at the Naval Air Station in Sanford, Florida, which is, the airfield is still there. The Navy's long gone. But I think there are more people here today than there were in all of Naples back in those days. Because a little secret was that we did a lot of nighttime training at low altitude. And my memory of flying around Florida was that it was pitch black. Couldn't see a thing. Because there was nobody here, and there were no lights, except for this narrow strip along the Gold Coast in the east, and then a little Tampa, St. Pete, and tiny dot around Orlando, and then Jacksonville, but the rest was dark, and it was actually pretty easy to find your way, because you look for the few faint lights and head there. I guess I ought to, Sandy's been, was very kind, and in his introduction, but it was the greatest of pleasures and honor for me to serve as the Pacific Commander when he was our ambassador to China, which happens to be the relationship that I think is our most important strategic relationship in the world. As we look to the future, there is none larger, in my opinion. Happy to take some questions on that if you're interested. But Sandy was a wonderful representative of our country, and particularly helpful to me because we tag-teamed very often against some of those occasional evil forces that emanate in Washington. So I had several battlefield commands, but no more dangerous than behind your back usually in D.C. Well, Sandy took care of all that for us. So I might have been his stick, but he was my real protector back in the political venue. So it might be worthwhile to tell you that retired about 8 years ago from the Navy, from the military service, but I've kind of kept my hand in. I spent a little bit of time up at MIT at the Center for International Studies. I'm on the Secretary of Defense Science Board and do a lot of things in the that dangerous world of think tanks around Washington. So I guess guilty as charged, I'm one of them. You know, one of the, here's the dope from D.C. to... But I have, I think, a redeeming value, and that is that Mary and I have a hideout in Montana. And it's a polar opposite from what you typically see in the near environments of the Beltway in Washington, D.C. And it's a real treat to be here because we were up in Montana last week, and the temperature registered minus 37 Fahrenheit, and snow is about yay deep, and so it's really nice to be here. Now, I was very curious about this deal, so if you become a speaker here, you get an opportunity to be invited to join the club. Does a house and a car and so forth, and your own ambassador come with that? See, Sandy? All right, got it. Got it. Well, I thought I'd talk a little bit about the international security situation, but remember, I'm a guy from Naval Aviation. And so got to keep things simple. And so I like to try to focus on just a few things. And we have some young people here. I was delighted to see and hear from you and to meet our young high school students here and to feel the enthusiasm you have for the future. And I would encourage you to work hard at whatever you decide to do. And I wouldn't be so sure that what you've decided you think you're going to do ends up being what you really do, but you'll reach that decision when you get there. So I thought I'd start out. I really want to talk about, really divide this talk into three areas. The first is the foundation, the fundamentals, and talk a little bit about security here in the United States, not the border security, not the walls, not the TSA, none of that stuff, but the fundamentals. We talk about international security. We have a tendency to point fingers, I think, and what about those guys? You know, what are the Chinese up to now? What are the Russians up to now? And I firmly believe that security for us really begins right here. Talk a little bit about that, and then we'll do a little bit of around the region, Asia Pacific, Middle East, maybe. And Sandy mentioned Russia's been on people's minds. Then I want to come back to some specific things I think we ought to consider doing if we really want to achieve the kind of security that I think we long for. So let's go back to the foundation. We have several challenges, I believe, in Washington that if we don't get right, then we could spend countless months, years, and sums of money around the world trying to make the place more stable, more secure, without any success. And these are things that I've observed, not just recently, but a lot of other people have seen too. And for whatever reason, we seem to have some difficulty coming to grips with these things that are very fundamental. First is governance. So I would pose a question for all of us, and then to have us turn it around to our leaders that we elect and send off to Washington and ask them, can you govern us, this country? That's what we elected you to do, but it seems to me that we're having some real difficulty doing that. And a lot of it stems from this highly partisan, bickering is too nice a term, this constant headbutting that appears to have gone on lately that seems to make it well nigh impossible to get things done. I'll give you a couple of my memories from the not too distant past. It was very, very fortunate to be serving in a senior military position in the international arena. Let's go back to Pacific Command, the Asia Pacific. When Sandy was the ambassador, and to know that the senior people in the Congress, at that time the most senior people in appropriations, Democrat and Republican, Senator Dan Inouye and Ted Stevens, Republican from Alaska, two highly different political views and backgrounds, but when it came to national security or anything that even smelled of a relation to that, I could count on these two gentlemen to get it done. They would make the decisions that had to be done. They didn't care what the issue was. They'd figure out what was best for this country, and they'd get it done. And this seems to have evaporated. And we better get it back, in my opinion, or we're going to have trouble. So the issue, the big question is, and by the way, it's very interesting to have this kind of bifurcated life, so around the Beltway in Washington and then Montana. So you get very interesting, different political views. There's a lot of hand-wringing around the environs of Washington based on the last election. I thought the suicide rate was going to go off the charts. A lot of anxiety. Oh, my God, the world is ending tomorrow. That's not the way it plays in Bozeman or Billings and in Butte and places like that. There's a great expectation for change, for the better. And I think that's pretty widespread in this country. I sense it down here, a lot of other places. But the key question is, can these people, these men and women that we've sent to D.C., actually govern and make it happen? We'll see. My fingers are crossed. My expectations are high, but something has to happen. The next item is the budget. The budget instability, that's a reality today. You may not recognize it again. Maybe you do, because you're not in Washington, but this country has operated for the last 2 years without a budget. Now, you see, I saw something in the paper just yesterday, in the journal. You know, Congress passes new budget. Not quite true. They have continuing resolutions, and these are so detrimental to long-term planning and stability for the government writ large, it's unbelievable. And that's what's going on. Why? Because our leaders can't seem to figure out a way to quit bickering and pass a bipartisan budget that actually will allow this country to function the way it should and to let our various cabinets, cabinet positions, plan for the future. You can't do it. So just my own experience, I was the vice chief of the Navy, kind of chief operating officer for 3 years, all the money, all the resources, and without an ability to say, we're going to take this much in, we're going to have this much to spend, you can't plan. That's the reality today. Has to change. Third thing, thinking. Not talking, not crafting memos, not going to endless think tank discussions of this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong, but thinking. Newt Gingrich gave a speech last month at the National Defense University, and he went back over his many years of history and service and so forth. And he talked about what he thought of where we were today. And he lamented this exact same thing. He said, we've seemed to have lost our ability to think strategically. Now, why does this matter? It matters, in my opinion, particularly in the international security and stability area, because if all you do is react to the crisis of the day, of which there are countless crises, and the reality of today's communications ability to have instantaneous knowledge of what goes on everywhere, if you're just reacting, you're going to react forever. It's an endless wheel. Believe me. When the new president raises his right hand and takes over, within minutes, the list of things are going to start coming into his desk. What are we going to do here? What about this? What about that? What about this? Sandy knows this in spades. It is really difficult to make decisions, in my experience, without a strategic plan. Now, this doesn't have to be rocket science. It means sit down, take some time, and decide, for example, where do we want this country to be 5 years from now or 10 years from now? We don't have to be all over the place. I think most Americans would fundamentally agree on a lot of basics. And let's just say, okay, we'd like to be this. We'd like to be good. There's a slogan, political slogan, want to be great again. Okay, fine. What does that entail? Strong, powerful, I would say economically, politically, militarily, probably less so. But need to have a plan. So hopefully the incoming leaders are going to get this. Yesterday, General Mattis testified to that exact point. We got to think strategically. Speaker Gingrich made that point. If we don't start thinking and have a plan, we're not going to get anywhere because there's just too much going on. Too many things come up, too many crises. It pained me as a military commander to occasionally have to call the White House and ask the boss for, okay, boss, you asked me to call you if this happened or get in touch with you. Now here it is. What do you want to do? Can you imagine how many other people were probably in that same boat and how many calls you would get in an average week? So have the strategy, have the planning that goes with it before you try to hit the ground running, and I think we'll be on a really good foundation. So these are what I think are three prerequisites to any discussion about international security and stability. You want to go around the world? Let's go to Asia, since we have some Asia hands here. I mentioned China and this relationship. Why is it so important? 1.3 billion people and climbing, an economy that's rapidly working to try to catch up to ours. Between the two countries, the economic power, the potential political power, the military capabilities, the countless whatevers, the influence and so forth, there is no close comparison. It's really important. And so I think we have to be really thinking about strategically where we want to be in this relationship with China. It gets back to the strategic thinking and planning. And if we react to the daily hiccups, you know, again, just reading the headlines from today, day before yesterday, Rex Tillerson said this. Oh, my God, now the Chinese have said this. And so here we go. When there's 1.3 billion people thinking and commenting on that side and, you know, several hundred million on this side, you can imagine all the stuff that goes back and forth. So China is really important. The linkages economically are pretty unbelievable. So any talk about we're going to go do this or the Chinese saying we're going to do this and not having a significant impact on all of us is unthinkable. And that's the key thing, I think, to keep in the back of our minds. We are very, very intertwined in many, many areas. Do we have differences? You bet. Lots of them. Behaviors. Things have changed. And I think that's one of the realities of life that we just, I believe, need to understand and accept. Nothing stays the same. The world is constantly changing. Example, when I was a youngster, young naval officer, went into the Western Pacific, and our U.S. Navy was about three times the size it is now, and we kind of owned the Pacific. We went wherever we wanted, and we would routinely steam very close to the coast of China for nothing else than taking shortcuts. So I'm in the Tonkin Gulf and I want to go to Japan. I'm going to take the shortest route, which happens to be as close as I can to the 12-mile standoff limit from China. And that's what we did regularly. You could see the China coast. Did the Chinese care? Didn't seem like it. Never any reaction. They weren't interested, really. They were interested in what went on inside of China, but didn't care much about the outside. But that's changed now. They care a lot about what goes on outside because they're much more powerful economically, and that economic clout has turned into a lot more money available for the military and for all kinds of things. And it's much more complex. And they want to play a role. And so, without being an apologist of any kind for China, they're big enough standing on their own 2 feet, the view that I got beaten into me when I spent a lot of time in Beijing was, from the Chinese side, you don't seem to understand, Fallon. You're an upstart. You're a youngster. America's what? A couple hundred years old? Do you know how long we've been around this world? 5,000 years? So, you know, we kind of look at you guys and say, sure, go ahead and talk all you want. But we've been around, we've been there, done that. And what they're talking about is they've been up here and down here. So over time, they've gone through cycles of seeming great powerness and when things weren't so good. Their view is that in the majority of the last 200 years, they've been down here on the low end of things, economically, politically, strategically. They've been invaded. They've been made fun of. They've been taken down. And that's over in their view. They're coming up here, and they're here now. So even a decade ago, they would tell Sandy and I regularly, we're on the way back up. You don't hear that anymore. Now it's, we're here, by the way. We're equals. Well, but that's what they think. And so their view is they've been held down in large part by Western countries, including the U.S. I mean, just think for a minute. Naval officer, got a couple of former naval officers in the audience here, I know. So U.S. Navy gunboats 1,000 miles up the Yangtze River. What would we think if we had a Chinese gunboat up the Mississippi headed for, you tell me where? That's what the Chinese experience. So they have a bit of a, you know, whatever. It's really important. But they're struggling, in my opinion, for a couple of reasons. One, they have a totalitarian government. It's a communist government, kind of modified, not like the Soviets. They're different than the Soviets. But it's one-party rule, and they aim to keep it that way. And that's the guiding number one rule. They have a strategic plan in China, unlike our seemingly having difficulty coming to grips with it. They know where they want to go, up here, and they know how they're going to get there, the Communist Party of China. They're going to get us there, and their leader, elected for 10 years, not elected, rubber-stamped, approved for 10 years at a crack, he's got some time. He's not worried about re-election next year. Trust me. He's there, and he's aiming to stay there, and in standing out, we're chatting, maybe longer than 10 years, but that's another story. So their behavior has been challenging to us, as they've had a lot more resources, and they've grown their military to be much more capable, and their interests have expanded. They've become a bit of a problem, because in their view, they were kind of kept locked up in a cave. Now they're out. And our view is, we used to rule this place. Who are these upstarts? And so we got some frictions. And nowhere was that more apparent to me than in the seas and the air, than the South China Sea and the East China Sea, which, as you know today, are very hotly disputed for a lot of reasons. China is changing. Back a few years ago, Deputy Secretary of State Bob Zelik at the time, some of you may know Bob, wonderful guy, Bob made the statement that we're looking for the Chinese to become responsible stakeholders in the world. I thought it was actually a pretty clever term and very appropriate. Chinese weren't so sure. They got a case of the twisted jaw on that one because they thought they were being mocked. But Bob had it right. And we tried to tell them in maybe more gentle terms, this is exactly what we want you to do. You want to play with the big boys and big girls in this world? You got to act like it. And that doesn't mean bullying the neighbors. It doesn't mean poking your eyes. It doesn't mean starting fights and things. You got to kind of play by the rules. And by the way, this is another reality. We, the U.S., wrote those rules. In the aftermath of World War II, the U.S., as the defining superpower, wrote the rules by which this world has been governed ever since. Now, the Chinese don't particularly like that, because in their view, there are rules made for our benefit, and we take advantage of it, and they don't. And so they're pushing to try to change. That's another hour's worth of discussion. But that's the reality. They don't particularly like the rules. They're playing by them, but they'd rather have their own rules, where they call the shots. And that's why they'd like to be up in that position. So they struggle. I could spend an hour in the law of the sea, South China Sea thing, but I won't. But I'll tell you just a couple of things to maybe keep in mind that might help make a little sense out of the endless media shots you see talking about problems in the South China Sea. Island building. Pretty touchy subject, right? Militarization of islands, reclaiming new pieces of supposed land, and then expanding national territorial claims beyond this. Well, guess what? Chinese aren't the only people that have been building islands in the South China Sea. The Filipinos have been doing it. The Vietnamese have been doing it. The Malaysians have been doing it. The Taiwans have been doing it. A lot of people are throwing sand in the water, and the Japanese buy it. Do that too up in their part of the ocean. But this has become contentious for really strange reasons. I'm going to tell you a little sea story here. As late as 1988, the U.S. government, Navy is the purveyor and provider of security for that government, recognized a 3-mile territorial limit at sea. 3 miles. That's it. Beyond that, international waters, anybody can come and go on the world commons ocean, as you saw fit. In the 1950s, 60s, into the 70s, a series of events took place in the North Atlantic may have escaped notice, may have forgotten about. Does the Cod Wars, C-O-D, cod as in codfish, stir any memories? The Cod Wars took place between Iceland, the UK, and other North Atlantic countries. And it was about fishing. Amazing, cod, fish. And the Icelandic desire to be able to fish, because that was how the country basically provided for itself economically, was mostly through fish. And they wanted exclusive rights to fish cod, because that's about all they had going for them. A lot of rocks, a lot of volcanoes, and a lot of cod. But the cods were going down. So they had this cod war. As a result of that and some other things, a convention went into place that began to recognize extended territorial limits. So I'll fast forward. 12-mile limit. So we, the U.S., now recognize a 12-mile territorial limit within which, this is our ocean, our coastal area, keep out unless you get permission. So, and we recognize that, and most countries do. But in the 80s, a suggestion was put into play, driven by this Cod War as the first instigator, to expand what was called EEZs, economic zones, out to 200 miles. Fast forward. This was implemented by a thing called the UNCLOS, United Nations Commission on Law of the Sea, signed as of this year, 160 nations, with one notable exception. What country do you think hasn't signed it? The United States of America. Every head of Navy and every senior naval officer for the last 30-some years has asked the President and the Congress to agree to this UN commission. Congress steadfastly refused. That's another hour lecture. But this has gone into effect, this 200-mile EEZ, and it's recognized throughout the world. Even though we haven't agreed to the treaty, we recognize it. Well, guess what happened to the South China Sea when all of the littoral countries and the countless thousands of islands that they all claim adopted the 200-mile UNCLOS agreement? The South China Sea is completely covered with claims, counterclaims of every kind. So this is not simple. It's not going to be resolved tomorrow. It's very complex, and it's just a reality. But it's changed the dynamic. You don't hear much about it in the newspaper. You don't hear it much on TV and the sound bites. But that's the reality, and it makes it really complex. So we're trying to recognize, even though we haven't signed this thing, what people have agreed to, we're going to remain steadfast in our claim and right to sail the open seas, even their 200-mile. This may be a 200-mile economic zone, but there's still international waters, and we'll steam there as we please. So you've heard of freedom of navigation, flights, and steamings, and we continue to do those. Anyway, Korea, North Korea, DPRK, very, very problematic. It's ruled by the Kim family, the dynasty that keeps on oppressing people. They're brutal. They've oppressed their people for decades, and they have a barbaric code of loyalty. You do what we say, or you die an ugly death. Example, the latest fearless leader with the bad haircut, Kim Jong-un, his uncle, who was his top advisor, crossed him somehow, so Kim decided to make a public spectacle of his execution. So he shot him, put him against a wall, and took an anti-aircraft gun, and he fired the gun to kill him. Not very pretty, right? This is what the guy does. That's how this country operates. The people have no say. He has all the say. With a guy like this running in leadership role, things get problematic. So very complex. Chinese are their number one trading partner. They do a lot together. We've constantly asked the Chinese, can you help us? You know, why can't you get these guys under control? Chinese, Fallon's opinion, they don't like what they do, but they're concerned more about the idea that Korea, one of these days, will be unified. North and South Korea will be one country. They're ethnically one people, very, very similar in countless ways. Sooner or later, they'll be together. When that happens, they know that the South will dominate because they do economically, politically. And so the idea that there's a 1,500-mile border with a strongly democratic government right across the border gives them the willies. And so I think they don't like Pyongyang's actions, but we'll kind of stay with it. But let me relate these two countries. I'll tell you a sea story. When Sandy was ambassador, Kim Jong-il, predecessor, put a brand new big missile on a launch pad, made a big public spectacle, told the world we have this new intercontinental missile that can reach the United States. We're going to put a nuclear weapon on it, and we're going to fire it. And if you give us any trouble, look out. It's coming your way. So I got a call one day from Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld. Hey, Fox, what are you going to do about that missile? Well, boss, what would you like me to do about it? He said, well, can you get rid of it? Probably a lot easier to do if it's still on the ground. He said, well, what if it's flying? I said, it becomes a problem. This was 10 years ago. We're much better, but it was a problematic. So there was back and forth. So he called me back in. He said, maybe you better call our allies out there, your buddies, and tell them that we could be in a position where we may have to shoot this thing, just so they're not surprised. If they launch it, we might shoot at it. I said, okay, good idea. And I said, I have an idea, boss. How about if I call the Chinese and tell them this, too? They're not our allies, but, it might be interesting. And he said, that's a really good idea. Go do that. And I said, well, I have one request, because the military counterpart that I talk to, we can't talk. It's like, just nothing. It was just, he was scripted. He read his lines. He wasn't going to get out in front of any headlights. But I said, now your counterpart, the Minister of Defense, he's a crusty old guy who once told me, the first time I met him, scrawny, skinny guy, with a nice 1950s style flat top haircut, graying, grizzled, and he goes, Fallon, I'm meaner than your boss, Rumsfeld. I'm older and I'm meaner. I said, yes, sir, I got it. But I could talk to him. So the secretary said, sure, call him. So I called him. I called, actually, the ambassador, and I said, I can't talk to him directly, but can you relay the message that I would like to talk to him? So Sandy said, sure, be happy to do that. So he called me back the next day and said, he was really upset. He said, they won't talk to me. They won't talk to you, Fallon. I said, what do you mean? He said, I don't know. They just won't. They just refuse to talk to you. And he said, I told him. He said, Fallon, I can talk about the weather. It must be something really important. Why won't you talk to him? No. Next day, they actually called in our senior military general in town, Sandy's defense attaché, General Jodis, Air Force General, and sat him down. They said, we have a message for Admiral Fallon. We'd like you to take this back to him. Ralph said, okay, what's the message? They read him a piece of paper and said, Dear Admiral Fallon, thank you very much for your interest in regional defense. We know you're concerned about our neighbors and the DPRK. Not to worry, we'll keep things under control and blah, blah, blah. Thanks for your interest and bye. So Ralph said, fine, can I take the message back? No. You can take a note. So he made notes and handed it back. So the ambassador was pretty upset. I was kind of puzzled, but okay. Let me fast forward. Next year. So by the way, the North Koreans did try to launch the missile. They got the firecracker, they put the flame on it, it launched and blew up and didn't get anywhere. But the next year, they decided to try another test, and this time it was going to be a nuclear weapon, or at least that's what our intelligence people thought. So this is, building up a lot of tension. So I get a phone call, this time from Ambassador Rand on my secure line. He said, Fox, I have a message for you. This is coming from the Minister of Defense to you. And the message is, Fallon, our neighbors in the DPRK are very soon going to conduct a nuclear event, I think was the term, translated. I said, well, that's really interesting, Sandy. Maybe they learned something. Not 10 minutes later, my other phone started screaming. It was Washington. Guess what? Nuclear event, something just detonated. So the Chinese can learn. Two messages here. One, the Chinese actually can learn from these things. Two, the DPRK is really a problem, and we have to be careful. Let me skip out of Asia and just a little bit about the Middle East. Iran. Iran's a problem. Iran is a problem for a number of reasons. One, because they have a group called the IRGC, the Republican Guards, that have kind of taken over the government. So the mullahs, the ayatollahs who run the place, have basically given this Republican Guard power to keep them in power. It's like everybody else. They don't want to leave. Once you get into power, a place of power, nobody wants to leave. So Iranians are no different, the mullahs. And the reason they stay there is because now the guard keeps them there. They also are revolutionary. This is really important. Why is Iran a problem? Because they want to change the Middle East and the rest of the Islamic world They're less interested in us. We're just a problem. But their Shia brand of Islam has been oppressed, in their view, for centuries. They want to change it. And so they're on a revolutionary track, and that's why they do what they do. They want to change the Middle East, and they want to be in charge. And that explains a lot of behavior. Another little sea story. I was really interested to see a couple of days ago, Washington Post, almost full page, front page. This was a story. Greg Jaffe, a journalist who I've known for a long time, wrote this story about General Mattis. Said, oh, better be careful about Mattis. In 2012, he went back to the White House and said, you know, these Iranians are killing a lot of Americans. Maybe we ought to put some stick on these guys, the big stick, and go after them and do something about it. And so the gist of the story was, here's a guy that's pretty unstable. You know, he's going to bring. I got to tell you something. 5 years prior to that, 2007, I did the same thing because I saw the Iranians doing the exact same thing to our people in Iraq. Said, we got to get these guys to understand. This is not going to fly. So I proposed similar kind of things, and we did what we did, and the Iranians got the message and kind of backed off, and Jim did the same thing in 2012. And so ISIL, Daesh, they're being beaten down. They're never going to be made to go away totally. But we got to keep up the pressure because they're dastardly, and slowly but surely you can see, maybe take some questions about Iraq. Russia, really important. Russia has great pretensions, again, of being a world power. They're not, but they have a lot of nuclear weapons. In the 90s, we did a lot of good things to get rid of a lot of the nuclear weapons that were not in Mother Russia itself, but were in Kazakhstan and Belarus and Ukraine, where a lot of them were. They've all gone away, thankfully. A lot of it funded by our taxpayer dollars, none Luger. Really a good thing. But the Russians have a case of the twisted jaw. They felt that we denigrated them, that we rubbed their noses in it, that we won the Cold War, and we kept beating our breasts about aren't we great and how bad these guys are. And their economics went to the tank, and they got really thick. And so they got Putin back. Who's a KGB guy, and he's determined, again, he has a plan. He has a strategic plan, folks. No doubt about it. He wants to make Russia great. He wants to make the near abroad of the former Warsaw Pact neutered so they're not a threat to him, and he wants to be seen as a world power. It's pretty simple. Why can't we get it? We're struggling. Putin is a master at things the Russians have been very good at for a long time. Deception, deceit, and denial. That's how they operate. There's nothing new here, folks. This isn't some new strategy. Tampering elections. Give me a break. By the way, did the U.S. ever tamper an election in Chile? I didn't talk about that. So be careful. Don't, you know, the media gets hyperventilates over stuff that there's not a whole lot new in the world. Russia's a problem, and how do you deal with them? I think we have to be strong because they recognize that. Weakness is just an invitation. This is Russia. I mean, to live in, have you ever been to Siberia? I mean, it makes Montana look nice. It's a really rugged place. They're tough people, and they kind of like tough leaders. And so the average Russian in the street thinks Putin's generally okay. His numbers are going down, but he's restored some semblance of feeling good about Russia that they lost after the Cold War. And so we got to deal with it. We got to be strong, but we have to be balanced, I think. Okay, how do we go ahead? There's a lot of cynicism in this country, a lot of it. There's a lot of discontent, a lot of hope now with the new election, but we're kind of, you know, a little uneasy in my sense. So what do we do? Do we fret about it? Do we wring our hands and, oh my God, end of the world? No. This is about people. It's about us. This is the American people, you, me. These young people, think of the things we've done in this world. We can do it. Again, we just have to get off our butts and do it. We've got to do stuff, not talk about it. We can do it. We can fix it. So the Newt Gingrich said, the system is broken in Washington. It is broken. By the way, he was a practitioner of the system, so he ought to know. He's right. It is broken. Who's going to fix it? Putin? Hope not. Chinese? No. They'd love to, but no. We're going to fix it. Service. That word service. Several people here said they had intentions to join the service. I think that's terrific. There was an essay in the New York Times, I don't know, a week, 10 days ago, by a guy named Carl Molinas. He'd written a couple of novels. He was a Marine veteran, a Vietnam, my era guy. And the gist of the story was, this country has lost trust in government and become very cynical in large measure. He tied it back to Vietnam and the way the government acted and the way things transpired in this country during the war. And he went on and made a case for that. But the thing that stood out in his essay to me was, he said, we seem to have forgotten about the word service. He said, think about this. Young people saying they want to serve. We say today, more often than not, they're going to join the military. And he said, and I agree, no, they're going to join the service. They're going to serve us. And by the way, I think this country would be one heck of a lot better off if we could convince the majority of people to have everybody serve and do something. Not necessarily in the military, but if everybody did something in this country, do anything. Service, really important word. Civility, another word. The other day I was privileged to hear Sam Nunn talk about it. Dick Lugar, his Republican, again, amazing, isn't it? Democrat, Republican, ideologically like here, but they got stuff done. And if it weren't for Nunn and Lugar, we'd probably have about 20,000 more nuclear weapons sitting somewhere in Eastern Europe or Asia today. But they got it done. They made it happen. And the former senator said, we need more civility in this country. We may not agree on stuff, but what the heck happened to decency? Why can't we sit down and talk to the guy or gal next to me on things that are of common good? Because there's so many things we share. Let's get it back. Deliver results. Unfortunately, or fortunately, we live in the Washington, D.C. area, where talk is cheap and ever-present. Countless opinions by brilliant people, PhD scholars from you name the great universities around this country, and they talk endlessly about how to fix this or fix that or fix... Very interesting, isn't it? But who the heck is getting the work done? These young people, very interesting. We need people to do all the jobs in this country. Everybody can't be the president of the United States of America. We need workers. We need people that will do all manner of things. I'll give you one more sea story. I grew up on aircraft carriers. They're floating cities of 5,000 people. Countless different jobs, hundreds of different tasks that have to be done every day. I would put myself in an airplane, get on a catapult, look down the bow at a pitching sea, and think to myself, you know, in about 3 seconds, I am going to be totally out of control. I'm going to be sitting in an airplane. People may think I'm in control, but I know in my heart that I have little control over this machine. There are dozens of people who have to make decisions and do things exactly right, or I'm going to go for a swim. And it might be pretty chilly and pretty wet, and maybe I don't get to swim at all. This is reality. It's this country. You got infrastructure problems? Fix it. You need bridge builders. You need welders. You need carpenters. You need everybody to do their piece. And if we all do it, again, the service thing, amazing what we can do. But we have to get stuff done. Last thing. One word. Leadership. We lead. The United States of America leads the world. We are the most gifted, most talented, most blessed country in this nation. In this world, this nation is most blessed, and in the world, and despite complaints from lots of people, including the Chinese and the Russians, they know that without U.S. leadership, this world is going for a swim in that pitching ocean. We need to recognize it. Don't be afraid of it. Don't be ashamed of it. Embrace it. Stand up. Grow the young people. Encourage them to serve. Do their part. Be leaders. And things will be one heck of a lot better off, in my opinion. This, I think, is important. We live in a world that is. It may not be the world we'd like, in some respects, but it's the world we live in. That's where we operate. So, people, it's us. We can do anything we want. Service, civility, leadership. It's simple, isn't it? Piece of cake. Why don't we have it done? Thanks for being here. I'll have to take some questions for you. Long ago. Thanks.
Thank you so much. We've had several questions on, you must know a number of the President-elect Trump's nominees. Could you comment on them?
Okay, I don't need the mic, I guess. I do. And my view is that gets back to some of these points I made. We have a newly elected president. Some people think he's fabulous. Some think people don't think that way, and most are kind of waiting to see what happens. We owe it to ourselves to help this country govern better. And so the best thing we can do is to nominate good people who are willing to serve and to have the capacity and experience to do a good job. So a couple of them I'm privileged to know. Secretary of Defense nominee Jim Mattis, I've known for many, many years, worked with him. He actually really thinks strategically. He's very talented and gifted in his background in the military. He's very greatly admired by his Marines and his soldiers and airmen and seamen that have worked for him. But in our dealings, what I take away from Jim is his ability to understand that we do need to have a strategic plan, we do need to have objectives, and that's where he's going to focus. Mr. Tillerson, unusual, I guess, but I actually know him. I've worked with him on a board, a nonprofit board. I really enjoyed working with him. He's very smart, and he doesn't know much about diplomacy. He'll be the first to admit it. We have a big State Department that does, and hopefully they'll give him the support he does. So there are a lot of other people, a lot of names popping up that would be really interesting. The reality, folks, is that when administrations change, there's a lot of turmoil, and it takes months before things get settled down. So the challenge for us in the security world is the bad guys are well aware of this, and they're looking for opportunities to kind of pull the string and see what puppet's going to jump to do what here. So anyway, best thing we can do is encourage people to be willing to step up and serve, and that's at the highest levels as well as the rank-and-file jobs.
Thank you. Next question is a student question. What was the tensest time during your service in the military that you had?
So see the hair? Used to be kind of gray. There are too many things. There are a lot of times when personally I wasn't sure I was going to make it through the next minute or two for various reasons, either in combat or in other situations. I probably felt the most inner concern when I had to make decisions in which lives of many of our people depended on me making the right decision or trying to make the right decision. So the responsibility for sending our people, our young men and women, into harm's way weighed heavily on my mind and probably is the most significant thing internally that you just have to recognize, and you trust your judgment and you make the decision and move on, and we're blessed to have people that are willing to do what you ask them to do and carry out the plan. So lots of examples.
Could you please comment on the importance of the Indian Ocean and the strategic relationship between the United States in India?
Sure. I didn't cover this one too many places in the world. India is really, really important in my mind for the future. So it's another huge country, another 1.3 billion people. It's a democracy, unlike China. It's very, very diverse country. There are lots of issues internally. They're not nearly as well off economically as the Chinese because they don't have a ruthless do what I say or else you're done. But they're coming. And for the U.S., we're in a new era now in the last probably 15, 20 years since the end of the Cold War, because during that time, the Indians were officially unaligned. That was their story, were non-aligned. But from the view of most of the U.S. leadership and certainly the military, we viewed them as in the Soviet camp, and so they were, if not the enemy, they were certainly not our friends. That's changing. The Indians were doing a lot more together, and strategically, it's one of the Indians see themselves as a rising power, and they see the Indian Ocean as theirs. That's why it says Indian is what they reminded me all the time. Don't forget, I, Andy, They are very aspirational. They have some work to do, and I think it's in our interest to cultivate a very strong relationship with them going forward, and we'll work on doing that. But they're very anxious over Pakistan. Another sea story, if you would. So I amused myself constantly by needling both the Indians and the Paks by telling them they don't seem to realize how alike they are. And, oh, that got me all kinds of grief. You don't understand, Fallon. No, they're very different, no matter which side of the border. No, they're very different. Not in my view. They're different religions, ethnic backgrounds, but they act very much the same. The Brits train them, so we blame the Brits. Very, very important part of the world and a really important relationship for the future.
What are your thoughts on the Iran nuclear agreement?
I think it was the right thing to do. I said so publicly. I joined with a number of senior people, a bipartisan group, to advocate strongly for that this be agreed to and adopted, and I think it's correct. And I was asked to go before our Congress and Senate on several occasions to testify and explain to them why I had that opinion, and I told them pretty simply. I said, Iran is on a path to acquire nuclear weapons, and they are hell-bent to do it, and they're working several avenues. And if they do, I don't see any good coming out of this. We are proposing an agreement that will remove their capability to create nuclear weapons for the next 15 years, nominally. I have seen no alternative plan that comes close to doing that. I've heard all the chatter out of Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. Netanyahu beat my eardrums and all of my old friends and buddies from Israel telling me how stupid I am. And I said, so give me a better plan. There is no better plan. And by the way, we've agreed to the deal. And as Jim Mattis testified yesterday, he's going to uphold the deal because it makes sense. Since that agreement went into effect, there's cement in the Iraq heavy water. There are two ways to make nuclear weapons. The physicists in the room. Okay, two ways to get there. You can enrich uranium or you can go the plutonium route. Both those methods have been removed from Iran. The stuff is out of there. They can't do it. Now, could they do it in the future? It's possible. But what was the deal? The issue was the impending creation of nuclear weapons. It's now gone. Have we solved the problems with Iran? No. Remember what I said? This is a revolutionary zealotry. They want to take over the Middle East. That hasn't changed. We'll have to deal with that another way. But the nuclear thing has been pushed back. It's off the table. And for all the hand-wringing and all these, you know, well, we can do this, we can do that, most of the proposed other solutions were complete bunk. So I support it, and I think it was the right thing to do. We've got a deal. Let's make sure that we get it implemented. And by the way, extend it beyond 15 years.
We had a couple of questions also about Iran that how could it happen that any sailors, that our sailors in two fast boats could be captured by Iranian sailors? Is there a part of this story we don't know about?
Buffoonery. One of my favorite words, buffoonery. Inattention to detail. Lack of supervision. All the usual stuff. Doing a pee-poor job. You know, happens in every organization. Navy's not immune to it. Who the hell was paying attention? Who was watching? Where was the oversight? Bunch of young sailors going from one place to another. One of the boats had problems, the weather, my uncle, my aunt. Okay, all these things are reality, you know? You always check the weather. You never go anywhere. I'd never get off the ground. I'd never even think about flying unless I checked the weather myself. I didn't take anybody's word for it. I went myself and looked and see, you know? Because I can't do anything about it. They trundled off and, assumed, and the bosses were asleep at the switch. It's that simple. Not pretty, but, you know, they went into Iranian waters well beyond inside the 200 mile, the 12 mile. They were right there, and they were had their heads up there, you know what? Okay? Happens. So, you know, who do you shoot? You know, my answer was, who the hell was in, you know, I've been a fleet commander, and I'll tell you another sea story. You got to entertain folks. I mean, things happen. Some of the stuff you can't make up. One winter morning, it was a Monday morning. I went into the office. I was the commander of the U.S. Second Fleet back in the 1990s. This was some fleet, I'm telling you. We had so all the ships in the Atlantic Ocean and all those people worked for me. So I'm getting my morning briefing. And the operations officer tells me, "We got a problem, boss." I said, "What's that?" "Well, this floating dry dock that was being towed from Norfolk to Florida broke loose last night, and it's adrift in the North Atlantic." I said, "The what?" Instantly recognized, floating dry dock, 1,000 feet long, 150 feet high, blowing in the North Atlantic gale in the middle of winter. First question I asked, who the hell authorized that to happen in the middle of winter on a Sunday with a single tugboat? And, the answer's got them. Stuff happens. So I, eating a little piece of humble pie, called the commander-in-chief of the Atlantic and said, "Boss, I got some, hate to tell you this, but here's what happened." "What the hell? Who's watching the farm, Anyway, stuff happens. Now, so I was responsible. So I gave some pretty succinct orders. Corral that. Lasso that thing. Find a cowboy. Get that thing under control. 10 days later, after the thing had drifted out into the Atlantic, it got caught up in the Gulf Stream, drifted north. It ended up near Bermuda. We had three ships. This is a comedy. It's like, you can't make this stuff up. It's just like the movies. We had three or four ships chasing it across the Atlantic, trying to corral it. Helicopters landing people, getting heavy cables. Finally, the thing drifted close enough to Bermuda. It calmed down. They were able to put a big, heavy tow rope on. Stuff happened. Unfortunately, it gets some negative publicity. But none of us are immune. We all have issues. Any more questions?
I'm sure we could stay here a lot longer and like to ask you more questions, but we've come to the limit of our time. Admiral
Great.
Collins,
thanks.
We'd like to thank you.
Thanks.
Terrific.